the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. As the lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. As the apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down under his shadow with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Stay me with flagons, comfort me with apples, for I am sick of love. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand doth embrace me.
This is Second Sunday, the NBC award-winning series devoted to an exploration of the revolutions within contemporary America. Tonight, Second Sunday probes the most explosive, the most challenging revolution of our time, the sexual revolution. Now, here is Edwin Newman.
Good evening, this is Edwin Newman, NBC News. We opened Second Sunday tonight with a reading of verses 1 through 6, chapter 2, the Song of Solomon. No more magnificent tribute to love has ever been written. This most sweeping of all human emotions is treated with humility, with beauty, with awe. Today, there are those who wonder what has happened to the biblical concept of love. Wonder, indeed, whether our culture may have forsaken love in its noble sense for the sheer sensual pleasure of sex. We will examine this question with a look at the sexual revolution. Some of what you will hear may startle you, some may even shock you, and certainly some simply will reinforce your beliefs and ideas. We've not set out to sensationalize the sexual revolution, but rather to present it as we have found it, through experts who are scholars, and through prostitutes, through adult eyes, and the views of children. We ask you to listen with an open mind. Our search is for the truth. Few authorities have achieved wider acceptance from other authorities and scholars for their studies in sex than the late Dr. Alfred Kinsey and his closest research associate, Wardell P. Pomeroy. Today, the prestigious Kinsey Foundation is headed by Dr. Paul Gebhard of Bloomington, Indiana. Dr. Pomeroy now is head of the National Scientific Society for the Study of Sex. At a recent symposium of the society, Drs. Gebhard and Pomeroy discussed, for Second Sunday, the sexual revolution, based upon their intensive and continuing studies of the sexual mores of the nation. The first voice you will hear is that of Dr. Gebhard. The second is Dr. Pomeroy's.
I would start out first by saying that there have been very definite changes in the openness in which people talk about sex.
I'll agree.
And I can cite specific incidences. In 1948 was the first time the word masturbation was ever used in a newspaper. This was in the review of our male book. In the late 50s began a whole spate of articles, open articles, about homosexuality in the media of various sorts. So the people are much more open, both in the various media and in private conversation, in talking about various sexual matters. Now, Paul, what do you feel is happening as far as behavior, such as more premarital intercourse, more or less masturbation, more variety of petting techniques, and so forth?
I'd say that if there's anything that is abrupt enough to merit the term revolution, it would be in this freedom to talk about sex, freedom to publish, in other words, just sort of attitudinal right. or communication level. But in terms of actual physical behavior, I think we'd both agree that while there has been change, it's been at a much slower rate.
Yes.
And the percentages have been really continuations of prior trends rather
yes.
than any revolution.
Paul, what effect do you think the development of contraception, first with the condom and later with the diaphragm and then more lately with the pill, has had on overt sexual behavior?
I don't think it's had a very profound effect at all. In the first place, it isn't involved in a great deal of sexual behavior, as you and I have often said. Its only effect would be on heterosexual intercourse. And here again, there have been periods, we know in history, when there's a great deal of heterosexual activity outside of marriage. long before the development of any effective contraceptive techniques, many cultures in various countries had a great deal of sexual activity.
So you're really saying then that the only real effect, the important effect of contraception is less premarital pregnancy, but not more premarital intercourse.
Yeah, as a generalization, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. You know, one other point in almost all the talking about the sexual revolution or young people today and they're going to the dogs and et cetera, et cetera, it's almost always talking about premarital intercourse. This is the big hang-up. For instance, when people talk about sex relations before marriage, you know, you can have all sorts of sex relations without intercourse. And I think people are losing perspective in thinking only in terms of intercourse.
Yes, and I'm glad you laid the finger on this great concern with the young. When they talk about premarital intercourse, they're thinking of teenagers. They're not thinking of, let's say, two unmarried people in their late 30s.
Exactly.
Society has no concern, really, about the people in their 30s and 40s. They're all hung up on the teenagers.
And I don't feel that the teenager is changing that much.
It is not possible to understand the present without understanding the past. How does the current upheaval in sexual patterns compare with other eras in the history of Western civilization? NBC News correspondent Dean Mell discussed this question with Dr. Barry Ulanoff, a professor of English at Barnard College, a distinguished historian, and the author of Faith, Hope, and Love in the Modern World.
Has there ever been a time in history quite like these times?
Not exactly the same, but certainly there have been times as interesting, as bawdy, as boisterous, times in which human sexuality has concerned people as much as it does today.
When were these times?
Almost all times, but in particular, I should think, the Middle Ages, and perhaps the 15th and 16th centuries.
Does libertinism run in cycles?
I think that in times of great change, when a society moves from one structure or set of structures to another, sexuality dominates human concern, human interest. That would not entirely explain our own time. It would say much, I think, about the enormous activity in the sexual area in the 11th and 12th centuries and again in the 15th and 16th centuries. In our own time, I think something more has occurred. I think we should say about our time that it is a time in which openness has been pursued as never before. This is a positive value.
Our attitudes toward what are commonly called sexual aberrations, have they changed historically?
I think they have changed, at least in the modern era. We're more open about them now. We accept today human fallibilities, human tastes, if you prefer. And therefore, we accept the fact that people will live all kinds of lives, including the lives that are generally called, in the most generally used vocabulary, perverted. However, if you go back, say, to the Romans, you discover that this sort of activity was very openly pursued. If you look at any number of civilizations in the Far East, you discover in prehistoric times and in modern times that there's been all kinds of homosexual activity and other kinds of perhaps aberrated activity in the sexual area.
In sum, you would say that our sexual behavior, our sexual attitudes are healthier today than at any time in our historic past?
Certainly than at any time in the American past. And I suspect than any time in the West since roughly the 15th century. I think this is a very impressive moment in the history of sexual custom, sexual behavior and talk, and feeling and thought about custom and behavior.
One disturbing aspect of the remodeling of the sexual structure in America, especially to us slightly older citizens, is the blurring of sex lines among the younger. What does this portend, the long-haired boy, the girl in sweatshirt and dirty jeans? NBC News correspondent Jeffrey Pond talked about the loss of visible sex differences with Professor Charles Winnick, the author of an intriguing, if disturbing, book, The New Sex.
Mr. Winnick, what's going on in American life in terms of sex right now?
To me, the most important thing that is happening is the blurring of differences, the development of a kind of neutered gender of appearance in many aspects of personal life, social life, even the very environment around us. And this is a process which has been underway since the end of World War II, And I think that it has a great many potential dangers for us.
How do you define this blurring, this neutered gender?
I think you only have to look around to see that obviously men and women, boys and girls, dress more alike. They tend to have more neuter names like Leslie and Dana. They tend to study the same kinds of subjects at school, to do the same kinds of things in leisure activity. Even in dancing, there's no more leading or following. They tend to live in a kind of beige environment in which beige is, in fact, the single most popular color. And this would all really not be very important, perhaps, or consequential, but for one thing. Why is it important? It's important because at the root of any person's ability to deal with his problems and cope with what is happening is a feeling of personal identity. He knows who he is. She knows who she is. Now, at the root, certainly, of a person's feeling of personal identity is a knowledge of their gender, whether masculine or feminine, and a knowledge of their age, where they stand on the life cycle. Now, it seems to me that it is these two very things, age and gender, which are most blurred. And when a person's ability to know what sex he is and a person's ability to know how old he is are undermined by all of these forces, then it seems to me that in the case of many, many people, these people will have a less sure sense of who they are, of their personal identity, and they will be less able to cope with themselves and with others and with their problems. And that is why, ultimately, I regard this as a very dangerous development.
If the blending of sexual differences intrigues, puzzles, and disturbs many, of even more concern to some is homosexuality. Never before has it been so widely publicized, so openly practiced, or so vigorously defended within the United States as it is today. There are two major organizations established by homosexuals, partially for their own protection, partially for social reasons. The lesbian organization is known as the Daughters of Bilitis. For males, the Mattachine Society. In the neat but slightly shabby offices of the Daughters of Bilitis, on a slightly shabby side street in lower mid-Manhattan, Jim Iyer of NBC News talked to an officer of the organization, a dark-haired, plump woman in her late 20s. Nearby, six other women sat at a table stuffing a monthly newsletter into envelopes.
How widespread do you believe lesbianism is in this country, and why?
Well, I honestly don't know, because most lesbians won't tell. In other words, Kinsey just covered those people who are willing to admit that they were homosexual. Plenty of people won't admit it, even to a researcher who promises anonymity. Many people have had homosexual experience, lesbian experience, and are not sure whether they can call themselves lesbians or not. Also, there's a problem of a great deal of frigidity among women. And, you know, what do you call a woman who is having sex regularly with her husband but is not experiencing any pleasure? She's not a lesbian. Is she a heterosexual? You know, what do you do? So it's really difficult to say under the current conditions.
What's your reaction to those who say that lesbianism is a psychological illness?
Well, I think they're wrong, because in my book, an illness is something that causes discomfort, pain, malfunctioning, disability of one sort or another. If you got a head cold or an ulcer or anything of the sort, you're not particularly happy with it. It doesn't give you pleasure. You suffer. This is not the case with homosexuality. If I, as a woman, go to bed with a woman, I generally have a hell of a good time. I wouldn't call that an illness.
Does one lesbian know another lesbian?
No.
Without saying where they are, I know you have bars and mm-hmm. various social establishments around town. Could you tell us what takes place in these places?
People drink, they talk, they dance together sometimes, depending on the bar. Sometimes they go home together. That's about it.
One of your prime functions is political. Would you expand on that?
Yes, we want to achieve equality. We don't want to be a despised minority group. We don't want to be considered some sort of degenerate fragment of the human species. We want a little bit of gay power.
Dick, an officer with the Mattachine Society, is a good-looking fellow, blonde, sideburns, who prefers turtleneck sweaters to shirts. Mr. Iyer talked with him about homosexuality.
Well, Dick, I'm wondering, in this society of ours, just how widely accepted is your group as professed homosexuals?
Well, the group isn't exactly all professed homosexuals. The group is concerned with homosexuals, and not only professed ones, but all homosexuals. And we're quite well accepted. Our work is not anything terribly controversial. Well, some of it is. Our law reform work and our in effect, civil rights work tends to be a little controversial.
Now, you talk about social activities, group functions in clubs and bars. Right. What does this consist of?
Well, like any other subculture, any group that the society doesn't provide anything for, homosexuals have formed their own subculture with its own institutions and even rules and regulations to some extent. Gay life centers around the gay bar, which is a place where people go not only to meet one another for sexual reasons, but to meet friends, make new friends. It acts as an information exchange center. They probably exchange gossip. They find out where the cops are heaviest this week and not to go. You can leave messages there for your friends and get messages from other friends.
How does a homosexual become acquainted with your organization, your clubs, and your bars?
Well, how they go about finding the gay world, as it's called, depends very much on the individual. In my own case, I read about it in magazines and books and just got all trundled up and went out and looked for it until I heard about it. Everybody in town talked about this bar where all the queers hung out, so finally I found out what a queer was and thought, aha, that's where I belong.
Most people refer to homosexuals as being feminine. Is this true?
No, not really. There are a number of, you know, effeminate homosexuals around. Effeminacy sometimes is a defense. Something like less than 1% of all homosexuals are visible to the outsider. Now, homosexuals can recognize one another, particularly if they, you know, the other person wants them to be recognized. The easiest way to tell is when you're walking down the street and you pass another man. Now, most men, if you pass them on the street, don't look at you. If they do, they look at you in the face. If a man looks at you in the face and looks down at, you know, to your feet and back up again, then you know good and well that he sized you up. It's just like a girl can tell when a guy's, you know, cruising around the street.
But the fellow doesn't have to be a hairdresser or a dancer. He can be a truck driver cab driver or a ditch digger.
Yeah, or a wrestler.
Yeah.
Racing car drivers are very often gay. That may be a gayer profession than ballet dancing, as a matter of fact.
Overt homosexuality, the blending of sexual lines, the confusion over sexual practices, all led a widely known author and social critic, Vance Packard, to turn his attention to sex. He summarized his findings in a recent book, The Sexual Wilderness. I talked with Mr. Packard and asked why he had chosen wilderness as part of his book's title, rather than revolution.
I prefer that to the phrase, the sexual revolution, which is an area of your concern here. A revolution assumes a clear movement in a generally supported and a generally agreed direction. I don't think that's what we have here at all. I think what we have is a vast amount of confusion, a vast upheaval.
Why do you think these things are coming unstuck? If they are, why are they?
Well, I think that we sometimes forget that we are in the middle of the most violent period of social upheaval in the history of mankind.
Is it something to be deplored or accepted, or should one not have any attitude toward it at all? Is it simply inevitable?
Well, I think that we shouldn't necessarily take the view that all change is progress. I think one of the shortcomings of Americans is we do tend to assume that all change is progress. I think that many of the things that we're seeing are regress.
Dr. Albert Ellis is a controversial spokesman for a new freedom of thought and action in sex. He's widely known both on the campuses and among psychiatrists for his books, especially Sex Without Guilt. Jeffrey Pond talked to Dr. Ellis about sex and guilt.
To what extent is guilt a factor in sex relations in America today?
Well, fortunately, to a much less extent. I've been in the practice of psychotherapy and sex and marriage and family counseling for 25 years now, and it used to be a big factor in the disturbances of my patients and in the people I speak to as I go on lecture tours throughout the country. But now, fortunately, as I said, it's a much less factor.
What are the young people doing in sex today in relation to guilt compared to their elders?
Young people today are not only having certain sex practices which they didn't have, and this especially goes for the females who are much less virginal than they used to be, but they're thinking about sex for one of the first times in our history. They're really asking, is this wrong just because the Bible or my parents said it is wrong? And if it is wrong, how will I calmly correct it instead of putting myself down for doing it?
Is petting coming along at a time in their lives when the first kiss was in the older generation's life?
Yes, very definitely. They're not only petting, but they're going way beyond the smooching and the hugging of 30 and 40 years ago, in that they're very frequently petting to orgasm. Females sometimes deliberately do this with the male in order not to have intercourse with him.
Many parents now seem to be in a quandary as to how to handle this. What would you advise? And what should the parent expect will happen regardless of his advice?
Well, for young, there is the children from puberty, 12 or 13, on to 16 or 17. I advise the parent very strongly, but with condemnation, to tell the child that, look, dear, there are a few real dangers of intercourse, such as pregnancy, and consequently it would be wise if you only petted and did not literally have intercourse. Now, in the older age brackets of the 18s and the 19 teenagers, I think, especially on the college level, that they can be fairly well left to decide for themselves whether they're going to have intercourse and what they're going to do about it, but they'd better be trained in school and at home to take wise precautions.
The sexual rebellion or revolution or wilderness or evolution has many of its more articulate and fiery spokesmen, though not always practitioners, in the nation's universities. Recently, a group of co-eds at Plimpton Hall, a dormitory at Barnard College, demanded the absolute right to have any guests, including men, in their rooms at any hour. Dean Mell dropped by Plimpton Hall to ask several of the young, attractive rebels why.
We want to govern ourselves. We don't think houses should be run by people who don't live there. We're asking for self-government. We think that each suite should decide when it wants men there, when it doesn't want men there.
Why do you want men in your rooms? Why is this an important...
It's not even that we want men in the room. We just... If you want men in the room, you can have men in the room. That's what we want.
You want the privilege.
Right, deciding whether or not you can have a man in your room.
Deciding who your guests are and when they come and go, rather than having someone else decide when you can have certain types of guests.
If you were granted these parietal rights, would you have men in your room?
Oh, yes. In 616 in Plimpton, there's kitchen, so you invite people up for dinner. You can study in your own room. You can sit and have a private conversation rather than in a crowded lounge.
Would you have a man in overnight?
That's for me, not for you.
The idea isn't to make it easier to have men in your rooms. The idea is to have your guests, male or female, come and go when you want them and when they want to.
I resent people associating what's happening in the dormitories as having to do with the changing sexual mores.
A distinguished New England college, Bennington, has, since its founding, given its students, until this year all girls, virtually complete freedom to handle their own lives. Bennington's president, Dr. Edward Blaustein, summarized his thoughts on the results of such freedom in a conversation with Dean Mell.
Dr. Blaustein, Bennington has a reputation, deserve it or not, of being a more lenient college in its attitude toward its women students, that they have more liberties, freedom to come and go than other universities. Do you find this true?
Yes, I think this is essentially true. Some of the regulations surrounding the governance of student social life at Bennington are much more relaxed than they are elsewhere. We have fewer parietal rules, and I guess we're one of the colleges that long ago gave up the intention of acting as a parent at a college. Bennington, since its founding, has insisted that students would play the primary role in the organization of their own social life. This means in the student houses there are no house mothers. The student house is organized by the students themselves. There will be a student house chairman. There's a student judicial committee rather than a college judicial committee. The entire organization of student social life is primarily within the control of students.
Would you advocate the Bennington system for other colleges and universities?
Oh, I think so, surely. In my own terms, the beginning of any kind of responsibility is freedom. Freedom isn't the antithesis of responsibility, but its very condition. Restrictive rules in relationship to people's sexual and social life don't tend to change the character of that life at all, except to remove responsibility from it. The freedom injects an element of responsibility that's necessary to its development.
The famous Kinsey study revealed that, even in an age of apparent sexual freedom, more than two-thirds of all adult American men have had intercourse with a prostitute, firmly demonstrating that prostitution is still a widespread fact of our society. In New Orleans, on Basin Street, Roland Ford of station WDSU talked with a still young, still pretty streetwalker about her quite thriving way of life.
What kind of men do you pick up?
The out-of-town people. Mm-hmm. Businessmen, older men.
Do you look for a specific type of person?
Yes.
What type?
A man about 50, 55, well-dressed.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, usually they have more money, and they're nicer people.
How much money can you generally make with one engagement with a man?
Well, most of mine are from about... Usually I try for 50.
Do you have a man that you live with, or a man that takes care of you?
No, no one takes care of me. Mm-hmm.
Do you know of any people in New Orleans, any girls that are working in a house? Is there any more of that sort of thing?
Not that I know of.
Is it often that you get arrested, or can you avoid arrest?
Well, I've been arrested for prostitution. I've been convicted of it. Mm-hmm. I've been arrested countless times by the vice squad. But no honest visible means of support, loitering, and all of those silly charges.
What's your future?
Well,
have you thought about it?
Yes.
What do you think?
I'll probably do this for a few more years.
And then what?
I don't know.
The world of entertainment, sparkling nightclubs, modern rock music, the theater, the movies, all have leaped into this era when anything, almost, goes to anyone, almost, who wants to pay the price. If one symbol might characterize the new sexuality in entertainment, it is the topless dancer. In San Francisco, where the topless go-go clubs were born, Barry Simmons of NBC News talked with topless dancer Yvonne Danger, a hefty 44-21-36, in a dimly lit corner of the Off-Broadway club.
I believe in there's a time and a place for anything. In other words, if it's on the stage, if it's well done, it's beautiful.
You think there's a place for walking on stage in the nude in front of an audience?
Oh, yes, because that's the stage. And that's a place for entertaining and to morally amuse people and give them something new, something different that they want to see.
Why do you think there is such a nudity craze in America today?
Well, I think personally myself, as much as I know about United States history, is that it isn't nothing new. It's just been advertised more because the burlesque and the nude shows, they have been in this country for many, many years.
Well, do you think the objective of all of this is entertainment or sort of a, well, you can look at all of this, but don't touch?
Well, don't touch, it's very definitely, comes first. And of course, I'm sure that whoever comes in this kind of places, and from whatever I have seen, is that they really don't come here to touch, because most of the time they come with their wives, with their sisters, with their sweethearts, you know. And I don't believe a man would even dare to do, like to really go crazy. He sees a semi-nude, entertainer and jumps on the stage, They wouldn't do that.
In music, the driving beat of rock and roll captured with frightening swiftness the sexual rhythm of the times. We asked Roscoe, heard on the NBC radio program Now, to look at this aspect of our culture.
The revelation of the sex revolution in music. It's revealed today in so many of our most popular rock and roll songs. a simple and unsophisticated acknowledgement of the reality of sex. Sometimes so direct as to be startling.
Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time for hesitation.
20 years ago now, there was a subtlety in titles and in words. For example, Love for Sale or There's a Small Hotel. Today, the statement and the approach are direct. The titles, I Can't Get No Satisfaction. Light My Fire, Let's Spend the Night Together. The changeover from yesterday's almost ethereal love song to today's blunt demand for sexual satisfaction didn't take place without a struggle in the music business. Radio stations often refusing to play some of the earlier rock and roll songs. But the tide changed markedly a few years ago. Now it would seem almost anything a teenager will buy can be sold or heard. You've heard all these before, but listen again more closely to what today's rock and roll artists really are saying.
It's raining inside a big brown moon. How does that mess your baby up leg? Eating a Reuben sandwich with sauerkraut. Don't stop now, baby, let it all hang out. Let it all hang out. Seem to end up on time.
Who'd you see that night? I was doing something right. Oh, the soldier, the sailor, and then there's the three musketeers. Yes, tell me now, who's been sleeping?
Reach out to me for satisfaction. Yeah. You've got to call my name for quick reaction.
Two widely respected and outspoken critics, Leonard Probst of NBC News and Judith Crist, heard regularly on the Today Show, took a sharp look at American movies and came up with some sharp observations. Miss Crist began speaking after Probst asked her why there was so much sex, so many more dirty words in today's movies.
Because it's commercial, to put it very succinctly. I think it is Hollywood's very belated reply to the relative maturity that we had been getting from foreign films and even in part from television.
It seems to me that the candor on stage and in films that we see now is reflected throughout our whole life, that there is an overthrow of false values, that is the expression of tell it like it is. There's an attempt to get at the bare truth. No question that a lot of it is done for shock and for exploitation, but it also seems to me that's part of our times, that...
Well, I think that, as with everything, you buy it for its artistic purpose.
But I don't mind. No, I don't. I'm not saying it has to be only artistic. I don't like that.
Look, we aren't the first, Len. We aren't the first people in history ever to use a four-letter word, you know. It's been on back fences and on the walls of men's rooms and on small boys' scratch pads since the year one. And Shakespeare had some mighty bawdy bits here and there, and Rabelais. I mean, it has very little to do with it. I think what people are objecting to, or I would say what people like myself object to, not that we don't know that all of this goes on and so on, but we realize that the use of the four-letter word is basically a symbol of a rather limited vocabulary. People know about human relations, sexual aberrations. I don't think I have to see it unless it is used either to illuminate, to entertain, to communicate in some way, something. But per se, I mean, I don't have to pay to hear those words. I can hear them for free. I don't have to see people in 70-millimeter projection pawing each other. I mean, skinny, scrawny women pawing at each other while there's some sort of lubricious soundtrack going on. And I'm supposed to think this is titillating? I mean, we're turning into a nation of voyeurs.
As I'm saying, if it's well done and there's a point to it, I don't object to the, you call it the four-letter word in the back fence being put on the screen. I think that's where it belongs. I don't want to see it kept on the back fence. And I don't mind the candor as long as it's well done.
I think, you see, that if the so-called frankness that we were getting were as a very large part of it is, but if all that we were getting was done with the artistry, say, of an Ingmar Bergman to start at the very top, or going all the way down to something that is to me so very sweet like hair, if it were done that way, it wouldn't even merit comment. But it is simply that because this has become acceptable on a quality level, it is being abused to the point where I am afraid that there is going to be a great public outcry against this, and that we may be heading for an era of censorship.
We are all familiar with the lurid covers on the paperbacks in the corner drugstore, though in truth the contents don't always match the covers. They do point, however, to the growing pornography in American literature. I asked Richard Gilman, professor of drama at Yale and literary editor of the New Republic, whether he feels we might not be drowning in a sea of pornography.
The question of the sea of pornography and our being inundated by it seems to me to be not soundly based, since most of the worst kinds, or that is, the most extreme kinds of pornographic writings, are not readily available. They're not flooding our newsstands or our bookstores.
It is nevertheless true that what is getting into the bookstores and the bookstands is quite different from what used to get in. Isn't that so?
Oh, sure. The change has really accelerated fantastically in about 3 years.
Caused by what, Mr. Gilman?
Legally, of course, the relaxation the Supreme Court has brought about, which is to say the narrowing of the definition of obscenity.
Does it seem to you that it can do any damage to society? Can it damage the community?
I think
Is the price we're paying for pornography too high a price, perhaps?
I don't know. I think that one always has to look at a question like this from the other side. What's the price for suppressing it? The principle here, it seems to me, is that pornography emerges essentially from repression.
Are we having a pornography boom at the moment?
It's tapering off, I think,
yes. Tapering. Mr. Gilman, is there any kind of reliable evidence to show a connection of any kind between pornography and sexual activity?
No, there isn't. But such studies as have been made have indicated pretty definitely that there is no connection. The implications of the studies are that, if anything, the reading of pornographic material serves as a kind of escape hatch, a way of working off steam.
Four high school seniors, two boys, two girls, each were recommended to Second Sunday by, in turn, a Catholic priest, a Protestant minister, a Unitarian minister, and a conservative rabbi. The four were asked to give their frank answer to this question. What would their own church leaders say if they were to seek advice on engaging in premarital intercourse under any circumstances?
I do believe that his ultimate course of action would be to dissuade one from engaging in premarital sex purely by the beliefs of the church, of the Bible, which basically forbid it.
I would think that my minister would try to dissuade me, because if you try and look at it objectively, I think that there's more of a chance before marriage that the consequences will be bad ones than good ones.
I'd most probably try to get dissuaded, too. But the thing is, I think he really can take into consideration, you know, how hung up I am on the idea.
I think what any church tries to do is preserve the family structure. And in a sense, what they might feel religiously, premarital sex can be a threat to the family structure. There's always a danger of a girl becoming pregnant, and then you have a family without a father. In our society, the difference is even greater than it had been, because you have such freedom among young people. And I think that the church will try and dissuade young people from engaging in premarital sex.
Then the question of how they would advise their young parishioners about premarital sex was put to two outspoken clergymen, Father Herbert Rogers of Fordham University, a Jesuit institution, and the Reverend Howard Moody of the Judson Memorial Baptist Church. The first answer is from Father Rogers.
I conceive my function to be trying to help them clarify their own minds. This is my function, and this is why I presume they come to me, because they could talk to me a little more easily. And my asking the right kind of question and my providing the right kind of understanding will help them to see what they really think, what they really feel. And if they determine that, under the circumstances, to the best of their insight, they're doing the right thing, I'm not going to stand in the way, present any great difficulty.
Well, I think my own position on this is that I feel something the way Father Rogers does. I conceive my function to be one of clarifier, and the context of people's relationships is terribly important to me. In other words, the basis upon which one sees this relationship and understands it is the most significant part of it. And I can't think of kind of absolutes in which I have to say prior to talking to people that when they come to me with a certain kind of attitude toward sex and so forth, that I'm going to say, well, that's wrong because you know what the traditional Protestant mores are, and consequently you should obey these. I think we have to at least listen to what the kids are saying about that relationship and how they conceive of it.
A generation nurtured on openness, on a new freedom of discussion about sex, on a new attitude toward sex, is in our high schools today. Even more than their older college brothers and sisters, they will be the products of a new concept of man and woman, sex and love. Second Sunday visited a group of 10th grade boys and girls in a Westchester County high school, and there listened while a class in humanities discussed the changing values of sex in a changing world. Here is what today's children in today's schools had to say on this subject.
All kids kind of dream the same ways and about the same things. And I don't think things are a lot wilder nowadays than they were, because views like that don't necessarily change with the times.
I think sex is just as well known now as it was then, except I think it's more brought out in the open at this point. I think it was more like a sin to talk about it. It was something you didn't talk about. But now it's brought out. I mean, like, we can have these kind of discussions and everything.
I think there's maybe more of an open awareness today, because books and movies and stuff are, like, a lot different from what they were, like, when our parents were young. Like, when my mother said she saw a Gone with the Wind, they thought one said, when he said, "I don't give a damn," it was the worst thing anyone could ever say.
The thing is that people that are younger, different than their parents, they're beginning to realize that sex isn't just some evil pleasure that you go after. It has beauty to it.
I think that one of the main differences in the attitudes towards sex today and when our parents were growing up is the pressure that these socially ambitious mothers put on their children, and there's more pressure on the kids all the time.
Maybe parents are pushing their kids out sooner, but they don't want their kids to have to deal with this big thing about sex. They don't want them getting in trouble with it.
I think that the family is coming apart, but in a way it's becoming closer, and that we can talk to our family about some things. And we're more open to say things that we wouldn't have been 5 years ago. I think that's completely wrong. There are basically two topics you can't talk to parents about, and that's drugs and sex.
I think today your parents can tell you what's right and what's wrong, but really, your parents don't want to believe that you would do anything wrong. Like, they can say, oh, someone else's child might be indulging in sex, but they wouldn't want to believe that about their own child. Like, parents are strange people, because they... I don't think your parents are trying to kill you when they ask you where you're going or what you're doing, because they're just trying to protect you, and I'm sure when you're all parents, you know, you're going to do the same thing.
I must confess that, as we have reviewed the sexual revolution in America, looking at our society without condemnation or praise, I listen to the children with some astonishment. Are these fresh, bright youngsters who speak with such sensitive candor also confused, rebellious, arrogant? Certainly they are. but they have a redeeming grace which the world may too long have lacked, an ability to be honest with each other. Tomorrow is not necessarily in worse hands than the past. This is Edwin Newman, NBC News.
The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's.
Light my fire, light my fire, light my fire. Oh, light my fire, light my fire, light my fire. Yeah,
I am the
girl,
rose of Sharon,
girl,
and
you
the lily of the valleys.
Light my fire.
As the lily among thorns, so is my love among the waters.
You better light, you better.
As the apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down under his shadow with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste.
This has been Second Sunday, The Sexual Revolution. Producer-writer Herbert Gordon. Directed by Al Reyes and Edward Smith. Editorial assistant Susan Peretz. Tape editors William Tuohy and Peter Bernstock. Second Sunday is produced under the direction and control of NBC News. Your announcer is Jerry Damon.